Would you like to accelerate your career and reach your full potential in just minutes a day? Welcome to the LeadX Show with New York Times bestselling author and Inc. 500 entrepreneur, Kevin Cruz.
Hello, everyone. Kevin Cruz here, and welcome to the 100th episode of the LeadX Show. It's a milestone episode for us, and when I thought about how to make it special, I considered doing some behind-the-scenes stuff, I considered inviting some listeners onto the show, but then I realized I can serve you best by bringing on an amazing guest for us to learn from. And in just a minute, we're going to talk about leadership lessons from the Miracle on the Hudson. But first, I want to say thank you for all your support. You believe in lifelong learning. You believe that to achieve more, you must become more. You believe that leadership in all its forms is the key to making an impact. Please tell your friends the LeadX Show is the smartest way to start your day. I am so excited to introduce today's guest. He pursued his childhood love of aviation and learned to fly at age 16. He graduated from the U.S. Air Force Academy, served as a fighter pilot in the U.S. Air Force, flying the legendary F-4 Phantom. After leaving the Air Force, he became a commercial airline pilot and received international acclaim on January 15, 2009, when he and his first officer and flight crew safely guided U.S. Airways Flight 1549 to an emergency water landing in New York City's Hudson River. This after it lost both engines to a bird strike. 155 lives were saved that day, and he would later be portrayed by Tom Hanks in the film version of this amazing event. That film was directed by Clint Eastwood. Today, through keynote speeches around the world, he teaches how to achieve the highest levels of performance, reliability, and safety through effective crisis management, continuous learning, and leadership. He is a New York Times best-selling author of 2 books. His second book was called Making a Difference, and his first book was his autobiography, originally titled Highest Duty, but it was republished with the title Sully. Our guest is Captain Sully Sullenberger. Welcome to the show, Captain Sullenberger.
Thank you, Kevin. Great to be with you and your audience.
Now, I've just given your official introduction, but just to paint a more personal picture, I'm curious, do you and your wife, Lori, still live in the San Francisco area?
Yes, been here, 35 years, twice as long as I've lived anywhere else.
Wow.
I grew up in North Texas, but lived all over the country during my Air Force service. But, you know, the West is where we call home.
Hopefully you're spending more time at home now than when you were a commercial airline pilot.
I still travel quite a bit now as a passenger on commercial airlines all over the country and the world. So I've been on both sides of that equation. I feel your pain.
I know when you wrote your first book, you talk a lot about your daughters, Kate and Kelly, and they were teenagers at the time, but they've got to be in their early 20s now?
Oh, gosh. I hate to be one of those parents who brags, but we're so fortunate. They're in their early 20s. They're both in graduate school. The younger one also has a full-time job that she's able to do while Wow. She goes to grad school. They're following their passions. I think they, like me, were so fortunate to find their passion in life so early. I knew at 5 I wanted to fly, and my older one's going to be a veterinarian. She's in vet school now. Always had that dream, and she's well on her way to achieving it, and it's hard, as you can imagine, but she's making the grade and the grades. The younger one is passionate about education, and in particular, public policy and leadership and education, and so she's pursuing that. And so we couldn't be happier that they've turned into the people that they have become. And they're a lot of fun to be around.
That's great. I've got 2 daughters myself, and it's nice to see. I always say, you know, I'll measure my own success when my girls are grown and older and on the right path. So you're obviously doing something right.
Well, I think that a part of that is just who they are. But I hope that we've modeled enough good behavior and given them the support and the guidance that they need at the critical moments that they have really blossomed.
That's great. Now, Captain Sully, we're going to talk about crisis management and leadership in just a minute, but I always ask our guests on the LeadX Show the same first question, which is, will you share with our listeners a time when you failed and what did you learn from it? Because we want to learn from that failure too.
I'm going to give you 2 examples, actually, a professional one and a more personal one. Years ago, when I was an Air Force fighter pilot, in the aftermath of Vietnam during the Cold War, and we were flying our training missions at very high speed at ultra low altitudes, practicing how we would defend Europe from a Soviet invasion. Even in peacetime, in that environment where you're flying in formation at 600 knots at 100 feet above the ground, you know, sometimes success and failure, life and death, is measured in seconds and in feet. And on one early flight, as we were doing this very low level, very high speed flight training, I got too close to the ground. It was a ridge crossing where we were trying to maintain a certain altitude above undulating terrain to simulate staying below Soviet radar where we couldn't be detected and attacked. And in crossing the ridge line, I didn't realize that the terrain behind the ridge was higher than the terrain in front of the ridge. It was a potentially fatal miscalculation. I had rolled inverted to pull back down the backside of the hill, and I had to push back up into the sky to keep the airplane from colliding with the ground because I didn't have enough altitude to complete the maneuver as intended originally. When we got back from the flight, I told my navigator, the backseater in the F4, what had happened, why I'd made that mistake, and what I was going to do to change my flying technique in the future. I said, "Gordon, I'm sorry, I almost killed us today, but I promise it won't happen again, and this is why." And so I took responsibility for it, and that was something that really taught me about the need to remain vigilant, you know, no matter how proficient you become, no matter how much experience you have, but you may suddenly face something unexpected. And that was a lesson I carried throughout my professional career. And in my personal life, I think, you know, every once in a while in my relationship with my wife and my family, there are times that I'm not the person I want to be, that they need me to be. And, you know, I take that to heart. And just like in my professional life, I know that my wife and my family love and respect me enough to tell me the unvarnished truth when things aren't working out. And then I make course corrections and maintain a better personal relationship with them. And that's something that's ongoing.
Both of those are great reminders for us. Now, I read your book, Sully, of course, as part of the background for this interview. And LeadX listeners, I'm not going to lie. I thought I was going to skim all of the boring parts until I got to the forced landing. But to my surprise, I'm not just saying this, great book, even if you took out the 208 seconds. I teared up, Captain Sully, as you were talking about what it was like adopting your daughters. I got some practical relationship advice as you talked about, you know, being an introvert, a man of few words, as your wife has described you, and how you've learned to kind of save stuff up to share with Lori. And it was interesting and shocking to hear about the insider account of what it's like to be a commercial airline pilot. Because before I read your book, I assumed that the pilots up there, when I'm flying every week, I would think most of them are 20-year military veterans, already got that pension. You know, they were flying in the Air Force, that they're making $250,000 a year, plus all the union benefits. And yes, they're on the road a lot, but I thought it was a fairly comfortable job. And then I read about your book, and it didn't seem that way. So tell us, what's the reality of being a commercial airline pilot these days?
Well, like many industries, it's cyclical. And, you know, in the 60s and the 70s, you know, it was a pretty good job, and we had good benefits and pay. But starting with the deregulation of schedules and fares, with the 1978 deregulation of the airlines, this economic tsunami of change began gradually at first, and then certainly by the early 2000s, and certainly after the 2001 September 11th terror attacks and subsequent downturn in flying, you know, hit to the economy, multiple airline bankruptcies, we had SARS, two wars, you know, the dot-com bust. I mean, all that together was a huge hit to the airlines and, of course, then consequently to airline employees. And we took huge pay cuts. I took a 40% pay cut in the early 2000s. Our first officer on the Hudson River flight, Jeff Skiles, because he was forced from the captain seat into the first officer seat and then took the pay cut on top of it, lost about half his pay. Wow. Almost every airline employee in the country has lost their pensions and replaced by a PBGC guarantee, pennies on the dollar, later in life with little time to make it up. You know, I'll never be able to make up everything we lost. So we were the working wounded We had been folded, spindled, and mutilated. And so the big challenge in terms of leadership every week as a captain, when I would fly with people, many of whom at a large airline I'd never met before, because there are so many pilots and flight attendants, and we fly with different people all the time, it was a real challenge to motivate them, to remind them not only what to do and how to do it, but why we must do what we do, especially in such a safety critical industry, and for whom we owe this dedication, of course, our passengers. And so every week, part of what we would do is, after the introductions are made, try to align goals and try to convince people that we needed to work together as a team. And that was something that was very dear to my heart and I had worked on for many decades. In fact, years ago at the airline, I helped to implement at my airline, to develop, implement, and then teach the very first such team building leadership course at my airline. I taught the very first one. And you know you're on the leading edge of change and culture change when you have to try to convince the pilot union safety committee that a safety initiative is a good idea and not just a threat to pilots' authority or autonomy. But these were human skills that we would be able to teach them that would give them greater abilities and help them be better and more effective leaders. And so we did. We changed the cockpit culture from the old days where it was autocratic and arrogant and people didn't listen to each other and didn't build a team, and the accident rate reflected that, to now where we teach them how to take a team of experts and create an expert team, and those are different skills. And so those are the kinds of things I've done throughout my career and I've cared about. And now, as a result of the famous flight, I've proven in the most dramatic way possible that all these things I worked on for so long really work in the real world, even in the most extreme emergency.
And Captain Sully, I want to come back to the famous flight in just a second. But before I do that, you talked about those hard years and that tough culture where everyone felt they were beaten down by circumstances. Those are your words. And yet you also talked about, on a personal level, you would still run down the steps and look for the lost stroller or use your personal phone to place a phone call to help a passenger. And I think there's a lot of listeners out there who say, look, I want to do the right thing. I do care. It's not that I'm resistant to change, but I'm so beaten down by change after change after change, they start to give up. So what kept you personally motivated to help those individual passengers when so many others just kind of gave up on the system?
Well, injustice just makes me mad. It just flat pisses me off. And it always has. And I didn't want to be a bystander. I talk about this in the book, you know, showing up for life. I knew that throughout my life, I knew that whether you've got a big job and a fancy title or not, whatever your station in life is, whatever you're doing, there is some sphere of influence that you can control. Even though we get overwhelmed by the enormity and the complexity of the problems and issues in life, you know, sometimes it feels like we're trying to empty the ocean with a teaspoon. There is something in some part of our lives, of our world, that we can control. And when we choose to try to make our little part of the world better, and it's a choice that we have to make every single day, we can make a difference. And so when I would go to work, I wouldn't just go through the motions and just try to survive, just try to endure. I would try to get some personal satisfaction out of having done a good job, a personal satisfaction out of having helped one person, you know, looking for opportunities to do something that was worthwhile. And when, you know, when you do that, then that goes a long way toward, you know, providing a life that then has a purpose. And when you can derive satisfaction and purpose and perhaps meaning from what you do every day, it just doesn't get any better than that. And so I would try to make my little part of the world, and especially as captain, when I was the leader of the team and I was by federal statute, you know, responsible for every aspect of the safety of the flight from start to finish, then I had the authority to make things right. It was my job every time I went to get to work on a 4-day trip of flights to try to make each of those flights, you know, safe, comfortable, efficient, right, just, good, you know, pick a word. Right. And when I could do that, then it gave me, you know, professional satisfaction. It was my way of fighting back, my way of resisting the inequities of the world.
And it's a good reminder that in leadership, you know, we have to lead ourselves first. And so even in a system or as part of an organization where things aren't quite as we would desire, you know, we still, like you said, go back to personal meaning, personal purpose and mission and control what we can control.
And it is a, you know, two-sided coin. I talk about this in the first book also, that, you know, sometimes if you go too far out of your way, if you go too far out of the normal bounds of your position, your job, then at some point you are engaged in enabling behavior. And in an organization, a company, for example, that always uses the cheapest subcontractors, right, and they do the least training, and they don't devote the right resources to certain functions, and they don't hire enough staff. If you're constantly spending your entire day compensating for the inadequacies of the system, you allow it to continue. So I had to pick and choose my battles and try to fight the system from within to make sure that they had hired enough staff, to make sure they had done enough training, to make sure they had devoted enough resources to do the job properly, so that, you know, we weren't being distracted from being pilots all the time trying to do everything else that wasn't being done. But we had to do what we could.
Right. So let's talk about January 15th, 2009. You're flying an Airbus 320. It's cold, but a very clear day, supposed to be going from LaGuardia to Charlotte. Jeff Skiles, your co-pilot, and 100 seconds after takeoff, just under 100 seconds, less than 3,000 feet off the ground, you run into a flock of geese. They take out both engines. And you wrote, "When we struck them and the engines were damaged, I knew in that moment that it was going to be a life-changing event. I knew it was going to be the hardest day of my life, the biggest problem I would ever have to solve. But I was confident I could solve it. I never thought I would die that day." Captain Sully, that jumps out at me because I have a feeling there were 154 other people on that flight that thought they might die that day. So how could you be so confident at that moment?
Well, the other 154 people on the airplane, you know, the crew had their jobs to do, and first officer Jeff Skiles certainly did, and he was my partner throughout this whole episode. I couldn't have done it without him. In fact, had he been a lot less experienced, had he not had the 20,000 hours of flying time that he has like I do, had he not been a captain before and understood how to collaborate with me wordlessly by knowing his roles and responsibilities so well, because we didn't have time in those 208 seconds to have a conversation about what had happened. I didn't have time to direct his every action. The passengers, of course, didn't know the full story. They weren't in control. They weren't experts at this profession. But I was, and Jeff was. And so even though we'd never trained for this, even though it was a novel event that we had never anticipated, we took what we did know, adapted it, and very quickly applied it to solve this novel problem. So I had to very quickly come up with a paradigm of how to solve even this problem. And the startle effect was huge, especially after almost 30 years of routine airline flying, where we worked so hard never to be surprised by anything. And I'd never been so challenged in an airplane for 42 years that I doubted the outcome. But this was very different, and it happened so suddenly, it was shocking. So the first thing we had to do was to force calm on ourselves, to have the mental discipline to compartmentalize and focus clearly on the few most important tasks at hand, and then have the discipline to ignore everything we didn't have time to do as being only distractions. So we boiled the problem down to the essential essence, and then began to solve it one at a time until finally we'd solve each problem at the very end. But we didn't have time to do everything, and much of what we did we had to do later in the flight because there wasn't time to do it earlier in the flight. But we flew the airplane. We began to take the first two remedial actions. Within 2 seconds, I turned on the engine ignition and started the APU. So we reacted very quickly. I knew inherently there were only three options, two runways that might be reachable, but it turned out with the reaction time were not. And the only other place I knew from experience where we could even attempt to land an airliner was the Hudson River.
Now, you make the way you just described that makes it sound like that was the obvious or only choice. But you also just talked about you had almost 20,000 air miles of experience. Jeff did too. And not all pilots have that much experience. In fact, I also learned from your book that the regional pilots, I think you can become a commercial airline pilot with as little as 1,500 hours. Is that right?
Actually, a bit less than that if you've done certain things. If you're a former military pilot, you have credit for some of that time. You can have less than 1,500 hours if you go through some of the accredited aviation university schooling and training, you can get some credit for some of that. But the overall requirement now is 1,500, which is up from the unbelievably insanely low previous minimum of 250 hours. But even now, some in the regional airline industry are lobbying hard in Congress to try to weaken even those minimum standards to provide credit for other non-aviation activities, you know, things like watching videos in a hotel ballroom or going to a non-aviation college and getting a degree of some sort. But there's no substitute for actual flying experience in the real world. It's through that kind of real-world experience that one develops the judgment and this paradigm I'm talking about how to set priorities even in unforeseen situations and how to solve any problem in an airplane, which is really the ultimate challenge in being an airline pilot, is never knowing over a 30-year career when or even if you might face some ultimate challenge or what it would be or how you had handled it if it's something that's never been done before. So that's the kind of mastery that must be present in every pilot's seat and on every flight on every day.
And just back to the Hudson decision, I'm curious on that day, if you took a random sampling of 100 other U.S. Airways pilots and put them in that same situation, I can't imagine that all 100 would have made the same decision, right? Like, what would be your guess? How many would choose to turn back or maybe to go into New Jersey? And how many would say, oh, no, the best thing is to forget about the aircraft and we're going into the Hudson?
There's no way to know, but I'm confident that many of my colleagues would have done something similar, would have found their own way to solve this problem. But, you know, we can't unring the bell. We can't go back before this event happened. And now that it's happened and now that we've seen at least one way to do it, I think that influences people's thinking about it. So that's an unanswerable question other than to say I'm confident that aviation professionals have that same skill, that same dedication, and could find a way.
When you listen back to the cockpit flight recorder, you say it's a fascinating sentence. You say that when you listen back, it was awful and beautiful at the same time. And you've talked a little bit about the beauty of the communication with Jeff that wasn't always spoken. There wasn't time. And to me, the most amazing, from a leadership perspective, most amazing part of that recording, it happens at 3:30 and 21 seconds, you ask a simple three-word question. So tell our listeners about that question you asked right before the landing.
I'm very impressed that you picked that out. You see, that to me is one of the more noteworthy things about this whole episode, this whole flight. Right before the landing, I asked Jeff a question. I said, "Got any ideas?" Now, some reading that think it was a flippant remark. Although people who know me well probably doubt that I'm even capable of a flippant remark. But what I was asking him, and Jeff understood clearly in that context, I was saying essentially, I've done everything I can think of that will help us. Is there any other action we can take? Is there anything else you can think of that would help us be more successful, even by a fraction? And Jeff's answer was, actually not. And he answered just that way, but it wasn't that he was being insouciant. It was not that he was resigned to some ineluctable fate. Far from it, we were fighting to the very end to save the life of everyone on board. He answered that way because he knew that we had done all that we could. The fact that we could have that exchange right before the landing is one of the most remarkable things about this flight and this crew. And it's an indication of how deeply internalized our not just the technical flying skills, but the human skills, the leadership and team skills that I used to teach, to use all of your resources to ask everyone involved if there's time, what are your thoughts? What can we do to make this better? What can we do to solve this problem? To innovate, you know, to not just rely upon my own thoughts, my own experience, but to draw upon his as well.
And LeadX listeners, you know, this will be a consistent, a familiar theme, but this is a simple but game-changing question. Got any ideas? We can't just assume that because we have an open-door policy, people are going to feel comfortable coming in. You know, how many lives could be saved? How many hospital infections could be eliminated if nurses felt comfortable telling the doctor, hey, you forgot to wash your hands? How many lives could be saved when you know, the doctors are willing to ask their colleagues and others around, do you have any ideas? And, you know, even in just more routine day-to-day events, we need to remember to, if we want to really focus on the mission, that means we got to take our ego aside and proactively seek out ideas from others. And that's what I found so amazing about that piece right there. And Captain Sully, most of us are never going to face a life and death crisis the way you did, but you wrote that recently, if there's one thing we know about business, it's that the unexpected does happen. It might not be life and death, but the unexpected does happen. And you say it's not necessarily the technical skills that are going to get us through it, but these human skills. You don't like the term soft skills. So tell us even more about that.
You're exactly right. And these skills, to my knowledge, are not being taught very much, certainly not in our business schools. And I've talked to a lot of medical audiences too, just as you indicated. These soft skills, these human skills, I would say, have the potential to do even more good than technical skills can. It's all about creating the proper environment. Leadership is responsible for creating a culture in which we all can do our best work. It's a matter of setting priorities. It's a matter of checking your ego at the door. You know, left unchecked, you know, while even though an ego can be a powerful force, driving energetic force for good, left unchecked, you run the risk of walling yourself off to the communication, the innovation of others, and having to rely on your own thoughts, your own ideas. So part of what a leader must do is make it psychologically safe, as you say, to be able to raise important questions. And leaders must make sure that we understand how to convince those we work with and who work for us that we not only need to hear the unvarnished truth, we want to hear the unvarnished truth. So we really need to change our idea of the nature of news in our organizations. We need to tell everyone, and through our actions model this behavior, that there's no such thing as bad news. That really the only bad news is news that is not acted upon effectively in a timely fashion. And that it's, as we would say when I was teaching the team building course at the airline, among crew members, even the most junior flight attendant should be able to speak up to a captain about an important safety issue. And it's not only his or her right to speak up, it's his or her responsibility to the team, to the mission, to the crew, the passengers to speak up. And we make it not about who's right, but about what's right. That's important. So what we do is we help to create a shared sense of responsibility among all the team members for the outcome in which everyone can't participate. So we flatten the hierarchy to a more appropriate level. We open channels of communication. We encourage input, time permitting. And those are skills that each of us can learn, no matter what you're doing, whether it's at business, at work, at school, or at home. Each of us can learn these techniques. They're transferable. And so much of what we've done in aviation is transferable to other domains. And I talk to a variety of audiences around the world, as diverse as nuclear power operators to financial risk managers, health caregivers, and others. And the more I do that, the more I learn about other domains, the more similarities I see. Because what we're all trying to do is to improve human performance in these organizations that all involve inherent risk.
Well said. Well said. Now, I know we've come to the end of our time, but before we wrap up, I always challenge our listeners to become a little bit better every day, do something different today. So I'm hoping you'll give us a challenge. What do you want to ask us to do today?
Well, I'm actually going to give you two challenges. Okay. In this fast-paced world in which it seems like the pace of change is only accelerating on a daily basis, often we are tempted just to respond immediately to what's ever in front of us, to just react. But if we as leaders and team members set aside some period of time every day, perhaps a half an hour or an hour, to free ourselves of distractions, to open our minds, to maybe even go outside for a run during lunch, and not just react to whatever's immediately in front of us, to the email, to the text, we have the ability to creative reserve. And when we have a creative reserve and not just fully committed to whatever's right in front of us, not just reacting, we can sometimes come up with the the insights, the framing of a question in such a way that we come up with a solution we wouldn't have thought of otherwise. That's certainly been true for me. If I get outside and just change my environment, get away from my desk, and broaden my perspective, and not just focus on what's right in front of me, I can often think of some unique thought, some creative way, some innovative way of doing something I wouldn't have come up with otherwise. And the second challenge I would give you is a more important and a more immediate one. Also because of our electronic devices and our perceived need for immediate responsiveness in our world today, we respond immediately to our electronic devices anytime they send us a stimulus. And we should not do that when we drive. Right now, for the first time in decades, traffic deaths are on the increase. I'm convinced it's largely due to distractions from personal electronic devices while we're driving. The single most effective thing that each of us could do right now, today, to stop that trend is to turn off, to mute, to put away our phones when we drive and do what we did 10 or 15 years ago. Wait until we get there to find out what's going on. Put our own needs aside. Delay our gratification. Delay responding to our need for curiosity for a few minutes. And that little gift of civic virtue would save thousands of lives in this country alone every year. We don't have the right to put others at unnecessary risk for our own convenience. It's a civic duty not to do that.
Powerful safety message to end the show on. LeadX listeners, there's an old saying, there are bold pilots and there are old pilots, but there are no bold old pilots. Our guest today was forced to make a bold decision and to execute a bold landing. And with his crew and first responders, he saved the lives of 155 people on board. Captain Sullenberger, thank you for your dedication to airline safety and safety in the broader spectrum then and now. And thanks for coming on the LeadX show.
Kevin, it's been my privilege. And let me tell you and your listeners, in that regard, I'm not done yet.
The best is yet to come. All right, friends, you've just learned how to lead during crisis from Captain Sully Sullenberger. You can get his books, Sully and Making a Difference, from Amazon.com or your favorite bookstore. Also visit SullySullenberger.com or like his Facebook page to keep track of what he's up to. You can also get my totally free ebook, Richard Branson's 7 Secrets to Leadership, at leadx.org/Branson. Thank you again for joining me on this very special 100th episode of The LeadX Show. Until next time, remember, leadership is not a choice, because leadership is all about influence. You influence people with your words and actions, but also with your silence and when you choose to be a bystander. We are influencing others, we are leading, all of the time. How will you lead today? Hey, LeadX Nation, Kevin Cruz again, back in the studio now. And this is for all of you hardcore folks who want to see a little bit behind the scenes of what's been going on and why I say I'm a little disappointed in my interview with Captain Sullenberger. I'm excited to have him on the show and I enjoyed the conversation. But I can't lie. I'm a little disappointed. So here's why. I was really excited for this interview. We had scheduled an hour with him. I probably put 100 hours of prep time. I read his books. I've read, you know, dozens and dozens of interviews. Of course, the movie, all this stuff. And unlike our normal short format show, you know, this was going to be one where I could go deep. We had the time to do it. You know, this would be in the style of a Tim Ferriss, a James Altucher. You know, they're known for doing deep dives with their guests. And a lot of you have said, hey, you appreciate the short commute talks, but with some of the guests, you wish you had more. And a lot of you also from our Facebook ambassador group, that's our VIP group, you know, you gave me questions to ask them. I thought they were good questions. So my goal was to cover new ground. And if you go Google Sully, you will see in interviews, in his media appearances, you know, he's pretty much giving the same answers to the same questions, and he's giving the same stories. Now, there's nothing wrong with this. I mean, I do similar things. You know, whenever you've been sort of media trained, you're taught that you can pretty much ignore the question that was asked, or at least you can pivot off of it to then make whatever point you want to make, to say whatever you want to say. And so speakers, authors, et cetera, you know, you tend to use the questions to go into your material that you've already prepared. You're not ready, nor are you really interested usually in covering new ground or something. You're just banging out interview after interview and you're going to your known material. And I wanted to talk about the miracle landing, but I thought this was a chance for us to get to know Sully in a way that he hasn't revealed, you know, more about his personal background, more career stuff. You know, what's the cost been to him and his family? You know, this fame, obviously he's brought a lot of opportunity, but what has the cost been? I'm curious about his journey into becoming a very good, successful professional speaker. He's now doing all kinds of cool work on automation in the automobile industry. And he's doing all this safety consultation. I found out in the research that very few of the safety recommendations that were made after that flight, the Miracle on the Hudson, very few of them have actually been implemented. Most have not. So I wanted to ask him, you know, if he could wave a magic wand and just make one change to improve the safety of commercial airlines, what would it be? I mean, I'm dying to know that. Like, what do we need to change next to make flying more safe than it is? Anyway, so what happens is we get on the phone and the first thing I do is I confirm the amount of time, you know, that we have for the interview. And he tells me we only have 20 minutes. So my head just about popped off and I said, you know, Captain Sullenberger, I said, I need more time than that. Like, what's the most you can give me? And he says, well, we can go 30. And then I told him, I gave him a heads up that I was going to ask him about a failure, you know, a failure and a challenge question at the end. And we burned, you know, probably 5 minutes as he wanted to talk about those questions and his answers. And he thought about it. And meanwhile, I'm just, you know, getting itchy in my chair. Like, I just see the minutes ticking away. I'm getting less and less time to interview him. So I made the decision. Normally I read the intro, all that preamble stuff, and the guest is waiting, you know, it takes me about a minute and they just hang out there quietly. And I like doing that because it kind of pumps me up, gets me in the right psychology. And I think them listening into my, you know, energy and the, you know, that it's the smartest way to start the day, what we're about. I think that gives them a little flavor for the show. It gets them ready to dive in and answer. It's not like a cold start. And so for the first time, you know, I just made the decision on the fly. I said, all right, I'll read your intro and everything later. I want to use our minutes for the interview. And it was a cold start. I don't know if you could hear it. I certainly can hear it. And, you know, I started by asking him, you know, about where he and his wife live and about his daughters, both because I wanted to, you know, build a little rapport. I wanted to throw some softballs out there. And, you know, I wanted to let him know this isn't going to be his normal tell me about the 208 seconds interview. It was going to be different. And I felt that he was a little uncomfortable, or he, you know, wasn't, he seemed off on his answer a little bit. I could just tell we were off on the wrong foot. And I went with another off question about, you know, I was fascinated by how little money pilots make. New pilots now will make $25,000 a year, $30,000 a year. Sully, in his book, talks about he was getting ready to go bankrupt. He had property and they owed money on it, and he was going to have to sell his house. And I wanted him to talk about this financial pressure that he was under that day. And he didn't go there. He mentioned that pilots have to buy their own meals. Like, they don't get meals from first class. They can't eat the food of the passengers. They have to buy their own food and bring it on. That blows my mind. Like, that is ridiculous. So I wanted to talk to him a little bit about the career stuff, the industry stuff. But when I asked him about it, he pivoted to a whole different story that he's, you know, told over and over again that he was comfortable with. So my questions weren't leading to the answers I was trying to get at. You know, a good interviewer, it's okay to, you know, ask legitimately new questions, but often it's like being a lawyer. You don't ask a question unless you know the answer. You know, I've consumed a ton of material and I've picked little pieces that I think will be most valuable for you, most helpful, most interesting for the audience. So I craft questions to then elicit this content. But he wasn't taking it. He wasn't taking the bait. He would just answer something else. So anyway, you know, I tried to get him, and I knew this was going to be a question that he probably wouldn't answer. But to me, you know, I asked him about, look, you take an average 100 pilots on that day. Not all of them are going to choose to land in the Hudson River. Some are going to try to make it back to the home airport, LaGuardia, and some are going to try to make it to Teterboro over in New Jersey. And I'm legitimately curious, like, what percentage of the pilots would have chosen the Hudson? You know, Sully says it's pretty much like he kind of knew, like it was, he's still certain that was really the only choice. And I'm not doubting that decision. I think he said something about second guessing or turning back. And I wasn't second guessing his decision. I'm curious, like, would only 10% of the pilots made that choice, or would 90%? You know, that's a big difference. And I think it would have put his decision to land in the Hudson into better context. Is it an easy decision, or is it a really unusual decision? But he wouldn't answer it. The only time I thought, okay, I finally freaking broke through, like I'm finally connected in the way I've sometimes been able to connect, was when I brought up his three-word question that was really the heart of leadership practice, workplace culture. When he asked, got any ideas? And he seemed legitimately like taken aback that I pulled that out. He seemed impressed by that. And he went on to give a good answer about it. Really good answer. We had a little bit of a back and forth. And of course, that was almost the end of the interview. Looking back again, hindsight being 2020, if I had started there, if I had sort of shown him, like, I've done my homework, I did my research, I understand culture and communication and leadership, and here's where I'm going to start, I think the rest of the interview would have gone a lot better. Maybe he would have, you know, given me more on some of that other personal stuff. Maybe I would have earned the right to ask and get an answer to that question about what percentage of people would choose the Hudson. I don't know. But anyway, look, it was an honor to have Sully on the show. I'm so grateful for him making the time. I learned some things. I thought it was a good interview. I learned a lot from the research. I'm just disappointed because I thought I had an hour. And if I had the full hour, we would have had so much more great and original content and material. And we don't have that. But maybe I can invite him back again the next time he's promoting something or doing a book. And, you know, I don't view it as a failure. I view it as a good interview with a lot of lessons learned. This experience definitely will make me a better interviewer and better prepared to handle things like short time segments when we get other high profile guests. That's it. That's the behind the scenes director's cut for episode 100. Thanks for all your support. I'm looking forward to another great 100 episodes. We are getting more and more unique guests. I'm getting better at my job, and the LeadX Nation is building. Who could ask for anything more? Until next time, remember, you know it, we are all leaders all of the time.